Some history shows merely scratch the surface.
It's one small step for man.
We go a little deeper.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
This is Deep Into History. How deep do you want to go?
Deep Into History is independent and proudly listener-supported. Before we begin, I would like to thank my newest patrons who went to patreon.com/deepintohistory and pledged their support. Tom and Michael, my new historians, I salute you and thank you from the center of my being. Also, a longtime listener and friend generously decided to support the show at an elevated level. So, Stuart, your level of support for Deep Into History is peerless.
Consider this a foreword. Today I need your help. I need you to prepare your mind to accept the shift in the historical paradigm. I need you to accept the fact that often history is written with or from a point of view that is prejudiced by the social norms and generally accepted beliefs of whatever society or time period in which it is recorded. This is unfortunately the case with much of Eastern history that is recorded by Westerners and vice versa. The parts of our collective story that have been altered the most, more than any others by far, are those of African descent. In the case of our hero to be, as the historical record stands, he's predominantly recorded as a slave and occasionally as a servant. Both completely preposterous origin theories, given what he achieves and how a completely alien culture comes to respect and even revere him. This tale is the culmination of years of reading, speaking to professors, seeking out tangential references and circumstantial evidence, allowing me to slowly and piece by piece solve this historical mystery and give it the authentic flavor it so desperately deserves. It gives me great pleasure to share this moment of history with you for the first time. Finally, the way it should be told, you know, the way it probably happened. So after a lot of thought and research, triangulating the lore and facts, no easy feat in this case, and acting in my capacity as your lore master, I've decided to treat our hero-to-be as the lifelong warrior he so clearly was, while offering the respect and recognition that his people so absolutely deserve. Consider that as we go forward. And with that said, this forward comes to an end. This episode is dedicated to the Wu-Tang Clan and all its members. Your beats and lyrics got me through some of the darkest moments of my life. Your words inspired me to seek my inner strength so that I could find the light again. Thank you for a lifetime of wonderful music. I can think of no better way to honor your art than with my own. So all that's left to do is throw a W up in the air and say, Wu-Tang, Wu-Tang. This is Deep Into History, and I'm your host, Arjun Hundel. I'm going to do things a little differently today. I want to set up the extraordinarily complex period our story comes from by first introducing you to some of our supporting cast, if you will. In a moment, you'll be transported to the battlefield of one of the most crucial turning points in Japanese history, and you'll witness it through the eyes of the man who would become known as the first unifier of Japan, Oda Nobunaga. So, the setup to our setup goes like this. A dynastic dispute between the two most powerful clans in Japan turns violent, all-consuming, and becomes known as the Onin War. It quickly escalates and spirals out of control, destroying any semblance of central authority in Japan. In 1467, it becomes a full-scale civil war. With no government, hundreds of local lords called daimyos rise up against each other to acquire as much land, castles, and manpower as they can. Like a drop mirror, Japan is shattered into hundreds of warring fiefdoms, and the result is 100 years of total war. Sengoku Jidai. It is a time of ninjas, Buddhist warrior monks, and legendary samurai. It is a time of constant battles, betrayal, and assassinations. And while every side has its heroes, every side has even more hated villains. It is a time of strife and blood feuds, where entire clans are wiped out, and when the humblest peasant can rise to become a great lord. So come dream with me as we take a trip back deep into 16th century Japan and the chaos of Sengoku Jidai, the War of the Clans. Ready?
Yes, my noble scribe. You can proceed.
Then let's go. You are riding through a thick forest at the head of an extremely long column of men, horses, and ox-drawn carts. To your right sits your friend and ally, Tokugawa Ieyasu, a powerful daimyo, looking very concerned and restless. You see his armored fist tightly clenching the reins of his warhorse.
You must relax, brother. We'll reach him in time.
You say, trying to calm your sworn brother's nerves. The column that you are leading is in fact an army 38,000 men strong. Tokugawa's son and heir is currently being besieged in a castle with less than 500 men of his own, who are quickly running out of supplies and under constant attack from the army of the feared and justifiably dreaded Takeda clan, who currently outnumbered the defenders 30-1, with vastly more samurai than any other army in Japan. Tokugawa Ieyasu grunts in reply. Always a man of few words, he is the most cunning daimyo you have ever known, and samurai to the core, careful never to reveal his emotions. Though you do notice that your words caused the grip on his warhorse's reins to loosen slightly. It was only days before that he had sent a messenger to you with the dire news of the siege, and you rushed to combine your forces on the forest road to make the long march together. You pat his armored shoulder like an older brother would. The alliance that exists between your clans, the Oda and Tokugawa, is an extension of the deeply held respect you have for one another. The fact that you have proved time and again that under no circumstances will you ever betray the other has given your clans the edge that they needed to survive and indeed thrive in the hellfire of Sengoku Jidai. In this age of constant backstabbing, betrayals, and suspicion, having just one reliable ally that you can depend on no matter what has enabled you to pick apart and destroy larger and much more powerful clans. In the process, you have both become powerful daimyos and have vastly expanded your clan's holdings, manpower, and resources. There is a rustle in the thick tree line to the side of the forest road just ahead. The sound causes your honor guard to bolt forward on their mounts and surround you. You see a ragged prisoner. Then, emerging from the foliage like ghosts, come three of Tokugawa scouts. Covered head to toe in black and brown patchwork with leaves and sticks strategically placed as camouflage. Only their eyes visible through slits in their cloth face masks. They push the clearly exhausted and filthy man out of the forest and onto the road. His mouth gagged and his hands bound. One scout pulls off his face mask and bows to both of you. You see it as a very familiar young man, and you search your memory for his name. Then it comes to you. He's Hitori Hanzo, leader of the Iga Ninja clan, sworn to protect your sworn brother next to you, Tokugawa Ieyasu. Hanzo's 80 ninja have been making constant sweeps of the forest, acting as scouts, disarming booby traps, and searching for signs of assassins in the woods. You are glad for their presence, as they are a powerful and incalculably valuable addition to your army.
We found this man running through the woods. He says he comes from Nagashino Castle with a plea for aid from your heir daimyo,
Hanzo says to Tokugawa, who then motions for the prisoner to be brought forward and proceeds to study the man's face closely.
Untie him. I know this man. He is of my clan. He is samurai to my son,
Tokugawa orders. The man's bonds are cut, and he steps forward and bows. His eyes widen when he recognizes you, and he bows again. Before he speaks, Hanzo hands him a water skin from which he drinks deeply.
Daimyo, I am Sunayamon.
He proceeds to give you a full report on the situation at the siege. Nagashino Castle is surrounded on all but one side by two rivers. The enemy Takeda clan has 15,000 foot soldiers who are attempting to breach the walls with deep digging sappers and are in the process of building two massive siege towers. Once completed, the siege engines would allow their huge numerical advantage to come into play, and the castle would fall. The defenders, holding on for now, are fighting valiantly, but were perilously low on food. By his calculations, with as little as 5 days worth of provisions left, you ask how he managed to penetrate the siege lines and reach you. Sunayamon proceeds to tell you of an incredible escape from the besieged castle. At night, he dived off the walls into the fast-flowing water. With his wakizashi, his short katana, the only weapon he carried with him, he swam underwater.
barely breaking the surface to breathe, and one by one cut through the nets the besiegers had placed there to prevent just such an escape. He then disabled their physical alarms of ropes hung with bells, dodged patrols, and carefully made his way through the enemy camp. When he reached the wilderness, with the castle still in sight, Sunaemon climbed the highest hill in the area and lit a bonfire to signal the defenders in the castle that he had made it out alive. Now, days later, starving and exhausted, he had reached you, only to find that his plea for aid was unnecessary as you were already marching to relieve the castle. The man impresses you greatly, and though you beg him, he refuses your offer of rest and in turn begs you to be allowed to make his way back to the castle to light another signal fire so that the defenders would know that your army was on the way. Unsure, you look to Tokugawa, who nods and looks at the exhausted samurai and says,
"Hitori Hanzo will guide you there and back."
All three ninja bow and help the men re-enter the forest. With their subtle skill, it is as if they were never there. Not a single footprint is visible.
"The Takeda clan has 15,000 at the castle, which means at least 10,000 knights, all samurai,"
says Tokugawa Ieyasu, in a tone something very close to despair.
"No one has ever withstood a charge from that many before. No one,"
he says, worry becoming his voice and completely taking over his demeanor.
"Trust in the plan, my friend,"
you say, while looking back over your shoulder, past your honor guard, at the dozens of ox carts stacked high with sections of sharpened bamboo fencing. The truth is, you have been waiting for just such a chance. For decades, the Takeda clan, with their near monopoly on heavy cavalry, which had been achieved through their jealous guardianship and hoarding of the only large breeding population of heavy war horses. This had allowed the Takeda clan to dominate nearly every pitched battle they had ever fought in Sengoku Jidai.
The samurai knights had wiped out the armies of entire provinces with just a single charge. Not to mention the fact that the Takeda, through their constant support of your enemies and direct military action, have been a perennial, venomous thorn in your side. No more. You were ready for them. Ready to bring down the arrogant Takeda clan once and for all. Knowing that one day, inevitably, you would have to face them. And finally finding what you thought was the answer to the riddle of how to defeat the samurai knights. You had spent the better part of the last decade preparing for this encounter. In the previous years, you were one of the very few daimyos to embrace, trade with, and learn from alien strangers from a very faraway land. They called themselves the Portuguese. They stank, ate too much meat, and couldn't use chopsticks, and you called them the Southern Barbarians. And they, in exchange for what for you were trivial amounts of gold, a few jade trinkets, and many lesser baubles, sold you a weapon unlike anything you'd ever seen. It was called an arquebus.
Slow your roll, Arjun. An arqua what?
An arquebus. A matchlock gun. A rifle.
Okay, I got it.
After witnessing a display of the guns, you saw their potential as weapons immediately, and you bought as many as you could from the Portuguese traders. And then had your blacksmiths copy them exactly, thousands of times, along with smelting millions of balls of shot. You sent your clan's own valuable merchants on perilous missions to distant lands to secure vast quantities of the ingredients for gunpowder. And though many clans now have the weapons, none have reached your level of proficiency with them. Your innovation? Having three lines of expert marksmen alternating between taking aim, firing, and reloading, so that there was never more than a 10-second gap between volleys. Years of drilling, training, and literal tons of gold had gone into preparing for the coming battle. A huge gamble on a tactic that had yet to prove itself successful on a battlefield. But you were Oda Nobunaga, and you were always willing to make an epic roll of the dice. You can't help but recall the time when you were 18, a newly made daimyo, and had ambushed an army of 25,000 men with just 2,000 samurai. In the darkness, you launched a daring night attack, and your few had utterly routed the huge army. The slightest grin touches the corners of your lips at the thought of Okizahama, your first glorious victory. The long days of marching pass slowly as anticipation of the coming battle builds among the soldiers of your army. You speak to your captains, telling them to reassure the men, for you know that they are all terrified of facing the charge of the Takeda samurai. On the third day, Hattori Hanzo and his Iga ninja materialize out of the woods on the road before you, with the sad news that Sune Eamon had been captured while attempting to light his signal fire. Hanzo's skill at stealth and deception had allowed him to witness what transpired next. The Tokugawa samurai was offered his life and freedom on the condition that he tell the besieged defenders that no help was coming and that they should surrender the castle immediately. The Takeda had tied him to a tall crucifix and placed him close enough to the wall so that he could be heard. He was surrounded by Takeda samurai with long spears. Yet instead of saving his own life by delivering the message, Sune Eamon yelled to his besieged comrades that your army was near, to hold on at all costs, and above all, fight. For this, he was stabbed repeatedly, and his body was butchered when it was taken down, right before the eyes of the weeping defenders on the walls.
We will avenge him,
you growl angrily.
Spread the tale down the column so all men know of his sacrifice.
Hanzo bows and silently moves away. You order one of your pages to make sure that Sune Eamon's family is sent enough koku, units of rice as good as gold, to live on comfortably for the rest of their lives. As the tale spreads, you notice that the pace of the army is quickened slightly. The men look more alert, and from their eyes you can feel that the men share your anger.
Good,
you think. On the fifth day, you finally breach the forest line, and the column that is your army slowly exits onto the vast plain that slopes down to a river. In the far distance, you can see Nagashino Castle and note that you have made it in the nick of time, for it looks like the construction of the enemy siege towers was nearly complete. A Takeda horn is sounded in the far distance. Your army has been spotted. This was expected, however. In fact, it was only through the efforts of Hanzo's ninja that your army's approach wasn't spotted sooner. Not wanting to risk being caught in the open while constructing a camp, you order your army to deploy for battle immediately, and your samurai begin yelling orders. You embrace your sworn brother, Tokugawa Ieyasu, for in any battle, there was always a risk you would not meet again in this world. He takes command of your light cavalry and rides out to secure your flanks and screen the force while it assembles. It is up to you to handle the disposition of the army. You give more commands, and soldiers assemble the sharpened bamboo fence sections into a broken grid, so that there is space between each, hundreds of yards across and many lines deep, forming a checkerboard pattern so that retreat and movement between the defensive fortifications was relatively easy. The broken line of bamboo stakes began on your side of the river. Exactly 50 yards back from the water's edge, the maximum deadly range of your rifles. From the dark gray clouds in the heavens, a steady rain begins to fall, and you smile. You are not concerned about your men keeping their gunpowder dry, as they have been drilled to perform in any conditions. The more wet the ground becomes, however, the slower the Takeda cavalry charge will be. Your 3,000 arquebusiers, riflemen, deploy in lines 6 across and 3 deep, behind each one of the bamboo barriers in the first few rows. In the lines behind are samurai and common peasant soldiers, all equipped with yari, long infantry spears, perfect for fighting cavalry up close. On the flanks, the Tokugawa form their samurai into blocks, wielding long yari to secure both sides of the line. Equipped with shields, they are a samurai phalanx, with the light cavalry screening for everyone. Your battle lines formed, ready. You settle in to wait. It isn't long before the entire force of dreaded Takeda cavalry leaves their siege camp and is riding towards your army. You notice that they had left their mostly peasant infantry behind to maintain the siege. Over 10,000 heavy cavalry, riding straight for you, a force that could crush any other army in Japan, perhaps a half mile from the river that separates you. The disciplined ranks of ornately armored men and horses stop to dress their line, forming a massive rectangular block. Many of the riders bear pennants and banners on poles rising from their backs, and under their helmets, each faceplate is unique. Some simple, many more molded and painted to look like oni demons, vicious animals, mythical monsters, or warriors out of legend. Each of the enormous war horses is in lacquered armor matching their riders, each delicate scale concealing a small steel plate. From their ranks, a horn is blown.
and their long, heavy spears are lowered, and they begin their charge. A single tear drops from your right eye and flows down your cheek. The samurai knights are beautiful, magnificent, even glorious. And they all must die for daring to besiege Tokugawa's heir. You hold up one finger, and the signaler in your honor guard lets loose a short, high-pitched burst from his warhorn, informing the army to be ready to receive the Takeda charge. Though the wet ground is clearly slowing them, they are now riding at a gallop and seem utterly unstoppable, until they reach the river, that is. The water, the submerged mud, an uneven riverbed completely slows down and breaks up the charge, just as you had planned.
Wait,
you say to your signaler, watching as the first few dozen samurai knights make it across the river and are desperately trying for their horses to gain their speed again.
Hold,
you say, watching as the dozens become hundreds. Then,
now,
the signaler's war horn blares, and in answer, 1,000 rifles fire at the massed cavalry. Attack! 10 seconds later, 1,000 more, followed by the last line of 1,000. And then, just like clockwork, the first line opens fire 10 seconds after that. Then 10 seconds later, the second, then the third, and on, an endless cycle of volleys. Exactly what you had trained your men to do, and they were doing so perfectly. To them, the battle was just a particularly bloody drill. The effect of the mass gunfire is beyond anything you could have imagined. Knights and their mounts are decimated by the nonstop barrage. Their fine and strong armor, more than capable of stopping most arrows, or even a direct slash from a katana, proves useless against the shots fired from the rifles. Even the riders that make it through the hail of gunfire are stymied by the irregular barricades and are soon cut down by your samurai wielding their yari. Though you question the enemy commander's wisdom for not withdrawing, the bravery of the Takeda samurai knights is beyond question. Even under the withering and lethal barrage, they keep coming, and in places penetrate three layers of barricades before being brought down. Light in the far distance near the castle draws your attention, and you see flames rising from the nearly complete siege towers and many enemy tents. Hitori Hanzo's ninja had struck the enemy camp and were slaughtering the enemy infantry, consisting mainly of peasant levies. Effective enough, but no match for samurai, let alone a clan of Iga ninja. After only a few hours, the battle ends, with only the Takeda leader and a few dozen retainers seen escaping the field. You have destroyed the most powerful cavalry force Japan had ever seen. 10,000 of them, every one a samurai. You move to the front with your honor guard to offer a chance to surrender to the survivors. There are only a few dozen, and to a man they refuse and ask to commit seppuku, ritualistic suicide.
Like, no way.
To atone for their failure and so that they may regain their honor in death. You nod your assent. One by one, they unsheath their wakizashi. For the few who wish it, your scribes record their death poems to be sent to their families. Then they take the short katana and cut deep into and across their abdomens. Your respect for these warriors grows enormously. You notice that there is one commander too weak to lift his sword, so you do him the service of a slash across the throat from your katana, dispatching him to the afterlife with honor. You turn to face your army and raise your blood-streaked sword to the sky and are met with a roaring cheer. Tokugawa Ieyasu rides up to you, a huge smile on his face, and yells,
"No one can stop you from unifying the provinces now, brother."
You turn and survey the carnage. In the distance, the shadows of the cheering men on the walls of Nagashino Castle are silhouetted and amplified on the rising smoke from the enemy camp by flashes of lightning. You ponder your sworn brother's words and think to yourself,
"Yes, men will call me Oda Nobunaga, the Unifier."
And then, as a deafening crack of thunder blocks out all other sounds,
No, you think?
One day, they will call me Shogun.
Come back from the battlefield. Let the men cheering on the walls of the distant castle and the smoking ruins of the enemy camp slowly fade away. Come back to deep into history and hear me say, this is the tale of an expert mercenary who undertakes an extremely dangerous mission for a considerable fee, which will sustain his people and allow them to continue to thrive in what after hundreds of years has become their new homeland. The tale of an ambitious and talented missionary desperate to survive long enough in a completely alien culture in order to invest its people with the love of Christ. And perhaps, just perhaps, open the first church. A feat worthy of promotion to the head of his order, a rank equivalent to that of a prince in Europe. The tale of a strange alliance that allowed the story of a bodyguard and his principal to burst through the fog of history and become the stuff of legend. The saga of how an actual alien friendship formed between the highest daimyo in Japan on his quest to become shogun, warlord of warlords, and the scion of African transplants who came as warriors to the southwest coast of India and there became entranced by an ancient way of life, who stayed there to devote themselves completely to and become masters of one of the first martial arts mankind ever created, Kalaripat, combat yoga. So take a deep breath. Let it out slowly. Put some smoke in the air if you choose. And just let your mind flow to my voice as we go deep into the world of the 16th century in the Common Era. And prepare to enter Yasuke, the African samurai. Welcome. To give our tale to be the authentic flavor it absolutely deserves, let's first take a macro look at the world as it was in the 1500s. It is the age of exploration. With the discovery of the New World, the powers of Europe are eager to claim as much land as they can, and in the process turn their kingdoms into vast empires. It is the height of the Renaissance, a time of deep thinking, which lead to incredible achievements in art and culture. It is a time of learning, which is as much about rediscovering the wisdom of the ancients as it is about seeking out new ideas. More than a few explorers scour ancient texts for clues about the locations of distant lands whose people may have access to untold amounts of gold and silver. For you see, these explorers sought to extract that wealth for themselves and their monarchs by any means necessary. Many are drawn to the tales of Marco Polo and his description of an island he called Chipangu, which was rumored to hold untold riches and was coveted by Mongol Khans. It is also a time of deep moral dilemma for the church. With the discovery of new lands and their indigenous people, it is their God-given mandate to spread the good word and convert them to Christianity. However, it is also a time where pagans, particularly those from Africa, are seen as a commodity by sections of the merchant class and are brutally kidnapped and forced into slavery. The vast profits from the slave trade and the subsequent lavish donations, in essence bribes, have for now split the church into factions, both for and against the vicious and soulless slave trade, with no moral majority from the moral authority.
Run that by me again.
With no moral majority from the moral authority, the trade spreads and expands, only to grow in the coming centuries. With incredible innovations in ship design and the rigging of sails, Portugal is at the cutting edge of naval technology. This has allowed them to round the Horn of Africa and gain vast wealth from the spice trade coming from India. They have set up colonies up and down the eastern and western coasts of what the Europeans call the Dark Continent, and established a heavy presence on the island of Mozambique. On the west coast of the subcontinent of India, the tropical port of Goa has recently become a firmly held Portuguese colony and a commercial hub for the small European nation. However, Portuguese influence stopped there. In the hinterland, beyond the beautiful port, a far more ancient way of life held sway, and in fact actively discouraged further Portuguese penetration inland, a society that took a distinctly negative view of the slavers, as if they took the practice of slavery very personally. Alessandro Valignano, an Italian born in Naples, was a Jesuit missionary who had excelled at his seminary training in Rome. He was so gifted at spreading the love of Christ and converting people
even devout Muslims, to the Catholic faith that he quickly rose high in his order. With his unheard-of success, he was put in charge of the church's conversion mission in the Far East, which included southern India, China, and Japan. His genius was to incorporate local traditions and celebrations and slowly cast them in a Christian light, so his missions experienced far less friction against the proud local cultures. He was tall and very charismatic. He spoke several languages, including Italian.
Sto bene, grazie.
Classical Chinese, which was spoken in coastal China and Japan at the time. Latin.
Multa sanguis fluet.
Basque, Spanish, and Portuguese.
Você é linda.
Another endearing fact, Alessandro hated slavery. He saw it as the barbaric practice it was. And though forced to interact with slavers by his church, he went out of his way to convert as many Africans as he could, thus by church edict, immunizing them from being taken as slaves. On previous trips to Africa, this had caused many problems between him and the Portuguese slavers there. He had heard vivid descriptions of the Japanese culture. And though he had only briefly visited the Far East, as we approach the year 1579 in the Common Era, he's preparing for his ultimate test, complete immersion in an alien land with a hyper-aggressive honor culture, where the slightest insult, perceived or imagined, would end in his death. He had a plan, though, a way to counter the random attacks from bands of samurai every other missionary had faced, ending up dead or without supplies. It involved getting to Goa and going into the hinterlands, deep into the hinterlands.
Stay a while and listen.
For he was a learned man who had studied history and understood what lay there, a warrior society that took great exception to the Portuguese slavers. He had read the reports of squads of Portuguese soldiers they had sent to explore the hills that never returned. He also knew why. They would have no chance against the warriors of Karnataka, the Siddhi, also referred to as the Habshi by the people of northern India. These ancient warriors from Africa had come as mercenaries and settlers, part of a Muslim invasion along the Indus River in Punjab in the 9th century. They were expert swordsmen from the central, ethnically Bantu plains of Africa. Entire tribes, women and children moved with their mercenary men. Once the invasion succeeded, those who wished to stay in the north had to convert to Islam or move further east and convert to Hinduism. And settling in either area meant always having to deal with the constant wars for control of the rich north. Those who sought a different way of life moved south, following the west coast of India, until they discovered the temples of Kalaripattu in the province of Karnataka. The city took an instant liking to the ancient art of combat yoga, and perhaps as many as 4,000 decided to settle there in villages with their families and devote themselves to the study of the art. Sometime in the late 9th or early 10th century Common Era, Kalaripattu, Kalaripat, or Kalari,
I'll take door number 3, Arjun,
is an ancient form of martial arts that centered around using yogic principles, postures, and discipline. When projected outwards, it created devastating yet oddly beautiful motions. Combat yoga. Unfortunately, the examples of the art that have survived to today are ceremonial and meant for grand artistic displays. The practice was banned by the British Raj in the following centuries, so knowledge of the many combat patterns has been lost to history. Historians agree that actual Kalaripat could be deadly in the extreme as it combined yoga, which gave extreme knowledge of one's own body, and Shushruta, which once mastered, gave one the ability to manipulate 107 nerves in another person's body. When combined with the quick, precise, even graceful strikes of combat yoga forms, and with the city's natural height and strength, the result were warriors nearly unrivaled in single combat. Alongside the offensive styles, they learned Ayurvedic principles that they used to perform healing massages that could cure many types of injuries. Every Siddhi warrior had to spend years mastering the weapons of Kalari. These included a long and short spear, a short sword wielded with a small shield called a buckler, a mace, a staff, 3 types of daggers, and uniquely, the urumi, a 4-pronged whip with claw-like razors on the points. This was worn around the waist as a belt and went completely unnoticed when they were required to disarm. In addition, it was required that they become experts in Mustiyuddha, an ancient style of boxing, and Mallayuddha, a form of combat wrestling.
Weren't you just using the Wu-Tang school method against me?
Picture a mix of Israeli Krav Maga and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, with a focus on killing or disabling your opponent from any position, and you'll have a good idea of the technique. They were also required to become fluent in several, perhaps as many as 6 languages, because of the huge variety spoken on the subcontinent. After mastery was attained of the 2 main offensive stances, every warrior would have to spend years learning the defensive stance, which is said to have allowed a single Kalari warrior to form a defensive bubble, wide enough to provide cover for another individual for some time while locked in the heat of battle. Once mastery of the defensive form was achieved, the city warriors were in huge demand as bodyguards for many of the royal courts and principalities in India and as far away as Thailand. Hiring a single siddhi was extremely expensive and required an upfront payment to their temple. They would then swear service to you, their life before yours, for an agreed and set amount period of time based on the size of the payment. The money would be used to collectively care for the siddhi people of Karnataka. Through their skill, these bodyguards became famous. Some even rose to high rank and commanded the armies of their lords. Upon his arrival in Goa, Alessandro Valignano, from here on referred to as the Jesuit, made his way into the hills of Karnataka alone, on a horse-drawn cart packed high with valuables. He dared not take any of the Portuguese slavers with him, for they would surely have been dealt with harshly. Instead, he held his crucifix out before him, trusting in God that the men of the city would see him as no threat and allow him into their temples. This worked. He told the temple master of his requirements, and after a long negotiation, a price was agreed upon. He departed, and upon his return to Goa, he was met at the docks by the man history would come to know as Yasuke. We know almost nothing of their meeting or their voyage, but it might have gone something like this. You are seated at a table in the crew section of the hold of a large Portuguese galley. The sway of the ship to the regular waves of the ocean is almost tolerable after the 3-day storm you had endured, which had hit scant hours after you left the port city of Goa in India. Having never been to sea before, the violent motion of the ship caused by the storm had been a seemingly unending spell of seasickness for you. Now, past the horrible weather, you have finally found your sea legs, and you are able to keep down some thin broth without your stomach churning. The ship suddenly tilts at a steep angle, and your wooden bowl of broth falls to the floor.
Rogue wave,
says your charge, as he takes the seat across from yours.
It's best to keep one hand on your dish while it's on the table,
he says. His Portuguese comes out forced, as if it's not his native tongue. The man in his black Jesuit robes sits and glances around as if to make sure no one is in earshot and says,
I was told you speak Latin.
You nod, Latin being only one of the 6 languages you speak fluently. Seamlessly switching to Latin, he goes on.
I'm sorry we haven't had the chance to speak earlier. I'm glad to see you're able to keep some food down. You must maintain your strength for where we are going. You'll need it.
Your eyes meet.
Your master told you of my mission?
You nod.
Good. I've arranged for you to have the space required for daily training deep in the hold of the ship. As far as the crew is concerned, you are my page and servant. Nothing more.
Again, you nod.
During our months at sea, I will require you to study the Chinese language with me. An ancient dialect of it is spoken in Japan. We both must become fluent in it. I'm told you have a basic understanding of these.
She,
you say, meaning yes.
Excellent. Do you know why I chose to venture so far to hire you?
With more venom than intended, you answer.
Because I look like them.
Waving your hand towards the far side of the room, where the ship's African slaves were being fed, chained like animals.
Yes, the perfect cover. The only dark-skinned people the Japanese have ever seen are the slaves on Portuguese ships.
When he says the word slaves, he sounds utterly disgusted, which you find endearing.
I hope that will allow you to travel with me without drawing suspicion or for you to be seen as a threat to the samurai. Many missionaries have died for giving the slightest insult while traveling there. As I don't fully understand their culture, it is entirely possible that I will unintentionally give offense as well. You will not be able to openly carry weapons, yet you must always be prepared to protect me.
I am Sidi. I am always prepared. You have my oath, my life before yours.
You say solemnly, meaning every word.
You may call me Alessandro.
He says, offering you his hand to shake.
And your name, my city friend?
You take his hand firmly in yours and say,
Yasuke.
The coming months aboard ship pass quickly, doing your daily training routines in the mornings. Afternoons filled with study of ancient Chinese with the Jesuit, speaking with one another for practice, and slowly becoming proficient in the language together. In the evenings, after the Jesuit has led the ship in prayer, you often share wine with him and speak of your people. On other occasions, he has you drill with the ship's complement of soldiers so you can learn to fire rifles and the ship's cannon. You quickly become proficient at using the firearms and are soon winning impromptu competitions against the soldiers with your accuracy. Finally, upon reaching a bustling port city in what you are told is China, you change ships for the short voyage to the Japanese port of Nagasaki, both of you ready to face the dangers of your mission. At least it might have gone like that. The situation in Japan was slightly more stable than during the Battle of Nagashino Castle that we experienced together earlier. The importance of that battle and its effects on Japan are very much akin to that of the Battle of Agincourt in Europe that we experienced in my tale, The Day Chivalry Died. The destruction of the samurai knights of the Takeda clan signaled the end of an old way of making war and ushered in the era of concentrated fire. Though in this case, instead of longbows, it was achieved with rifles. Oda Nobunaga is now called the Unifier and is close to his goal of becoming Shogun of Japan, meaning Warlord of Warlords, or Generalissimo. Though still gripped in the chaos and bloodshed of Sengoku Jidai, the south-central provinces on the main island of Honshu are firmly under his control, and there's a semblance of central authority returning for the first time in many decades. His most loyal vassal and friend, Tokugawa Ieyasu, has become a major power in his own right and leads their armies, constantly pushing and expanding the boundaries of their dominion in the north. While Oda Nobunaga's most skilled general, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, has become his lethal right hand and is expanding their dominions to the south, while other vassals handle local uprisings and diplomacy. The Unifier has brilliantly kept the ancient family of the emperor as puppet leaders, completely symbolic and ceremonial while he controls everything. Oda's rule is strict, absolute, and bloody. At the slightest sense of betrayal, he has ordered entire clans to be wiped out. Though he is loved and revered by many, his regime is maintained through fear and extreme violence. Remember, we are still in Sengoku Jidai, and the War of the Clans rages like wildfire in the rest of the country. The Jesuit's plan for himself and Yasuke to proceed from the port of Nagasaki and follow the country road to the capital works perfectly. As far as we know, they were not accosted on the road. Or if they were, Yasuke quickly and quietly dealt with the attackers. Along the way, they made stops at castles and manor houses of local daimyos, offering gifts of silk from China in exchange for their hospitality and for the Jesuit to spread the word of his god. He was a truly gifted missionary, and Yasuke witnesses him convert many samurai and their retainers to Christianity. Never remaining in one place for too long, the Jesuit wished to reach the capital of Kyoto and try to ingratiate himself with local officials and possibly, by bestowing lavish gifts and bribes, gain an audience with the Unifier himself. Little did he know that he need not have bothered, because upon entering the capital, all his plans are rendered useless because of Yasuke. You see, Kyoto lays inland, And as a result, the people there were not exposed to foreigners on their ships, let alone a person of African descent. They had never seen a black man before, and huge crowds gathered to look at him, and if they could, touch him. In fact, the Japanese people were so curious that soon many riots erupted whenever the pair were seen in public. Oda Nobunaga was a man who liked his city and its citizens orderly and compliant. Reports of these civil disruptions reached his ears, and he ordered the strange pair to be brought before him. Not long after, the Jesuit and Yasuke were surrounded by a dozen samurai and marched to the Unifier's palace at sword point. The fateful meeting after this. I hope you are enjoying this experience we share. I know I enjoy creating them for you, and I could really use your help to keep the lights on, if you will. Please go to patreon.com/deepintohistory and pledge your support. You'll gain access to my ever-growing library of Patreon-exclusive tales. And later this month, be the first to experience the epic tie-in versus Reform. After the catastrophic Battle of Arausio, the Republic of Rome is on its knees. But then, Speas.
Hope.
When the heroes of the African legions return, the eagles of Jupiter, and so seductive, meet and mingle. As we experience the politics, the passion, the fear,
the love,
the hatred, the divisions, in the late Republic's most desperate hour, the Marian reforms, like you've never, ever experienced them before on any medium. When verses, the saga of how the Republic fell to the Empire continues. This month, available first on Patreon and Spotify. Now back to Enter Yasuke, the African Samurai. The Jesuit and Yasuke were ushered into the ornate and elegant throne room of the Kyoto Palace. The room was filled with scribes and petitioners from the provinces. The walls of the room were covered in large maps with gorgeously crafted pins indicating the location and disposition of armies. For above all, to become shogun was to prove that he was warlord of warlords and that Oda Nobunaga could direct the campaigns of entire armies when he wasn't leading one himself. There was a constant stream of messengers coming in and out of the room, either bringing news from the provinces or from the front. When the pair reached the center of the chamber, the noise and bustle disappeared, and one could hear a pin drop. Everyone, from the humblest servant to visiting vassal lords, were staring at Yasuke in shock and complete disbelief. While some were no doubt equally curious about the Jesuit, you have to remember that no one there had ever seen an African person before. Though not the same, of course, we're all human after all. This is as akin to an actual alien encounter as it gets in history. Oda Nobunaga, the Unifier, though equally mystified by Yasuke, was far more suspicious than he was amazed. He ordered his retainers to bring soap and water and scrub the city's skin clean of what he assumed was makeup or paint, after which he would have the pair dealt with harshly for their fraud. Yasuke removed his shirt and allowed them to give him what amounted to a public bath.
How awkward.
And it soon became clear that he was as real as they were. Intrigued, the Unifier ordered the room cleared and spoke with them alone. He had long had dealings with the Portuguese and knew much and more about the missionaries who had come before. Remember that Yasuke's role as bodyguard required him to remain silent, watch, and listen. It's doubtful that he said much at this meeting. From Japanese sources, we know that they recorded Yasuke as being 6'2" tall and heavily muscled. He wouldn't have had the telltale whip and lash scars covering his back and torso that was indicative of slavery. This was made plain to the entire court when his shirt was removed. It's safe to say that Oda Nobunaga was more than a little curious about the large African, because he offered guides to escort the Jesuit and his strange companion to a few towns in the region so that the missionary could spread word of his religion and then be escorted back to the palace. Such a generous offer from such a powerful warlord would have been impossible to refuse. I want to take a moment and mention something that rang true to me throughout my research. It's this. Trained warriors conduct themselves differently than normal people. Call it elan, self-confidence, even chivalry.
I'm sure many of you know people who served in the military, and in particular, those who served in special elite forces have a certain quiet self-assuredness about them. This would have been doubly true for warriors of this era, who trained since boyhood and knew no other life. You know the saying, real recognizes real? I say this because I suspect this was the root of Oda Nobunaga's suspicions about Yasuke. The Jesuit and his bodyguard departed on their two-week mission with the Oda's guides. Now, no source records what happened on that trip, but I suspect that the party was waylaid by a few ronin, masterless samurai who often turned to banditry to support themselves. In this circumstance, Yasuke would have dropped his disguise, entered the Kalari defensive stance, pushing the Jesuit behind him, and crushed the highwaymen. The guide sent with them would have reported this. I suspect that an event like this took place because soon after they returned to the palace in Kyoto, Oda Nobunaga asked to speak to Yasuke alone. It was the first of many long conversations that they would share over the coming days. Yasuke even took part in wrestling bouts against master samurai and consistently won, thrilling the Unifier's court and earning huge windfalls for those who chose to bet on him. They spent more time talking together each day. We have no idea what was said, but we can guess that the warriors shared information about their cultures and fighting styles. I believe, and the few sources insinuate, that a genuine friendship formed between the two very different men. What came next must have been a complete shock for the Jesuit. The Unifier offered to allow him to build the first Catholic church in Japan, his greatest desire, if he would release Yasuke from his service so that he could join the Unifier's court as a page. This was a miraculously generous offer and must have seemed like a gift from God, as the Jesuit happily accepted. And just like that, Yasuke became the equivalent of a squire to Oda Nobunaga. He was instructed in the warrior code of the samurai, Bushido. Its eight virtues as follows.
Number one.
Righteousness, G. To the true warrior, all points of view are deeply considered regarding honesty, justice, and integrity. Warriors always make a full commitment to their decisions.
Number two.
Heroic courage, U. Living life in a shell like a turtle is not a life worth living. Calculated risk gives life the spice a warrior deserves.
Number three.
Benevolence and compassion, Jin. True warriors help their fellow men at every opportunity. If an opportunity does not arise, they go out of their way to find one.
Number four.
Respect, Rei. True warriors have no reason to be cruel.
Number five.
Honesty, Makoto. When warriors say that they will perform an action, it is as good as done. They do not have to give their word. They do not have to promise. Speaking and doing are the same action.
Number six.
Honor, Mayo. Warriors have only one judge of honor and character, and it is themselves. Their decisions and actions are a reflection of who they truly are. You cannot hide from yourself.
Number seven.
Duty and loyalty, Chugi. To everyone that they are responsible to and for, they remain fiercely loyal.
And last but not least, number eight.
Self-control, GC. Moderation in all things, especially indulging in one's own desires, is the key to a balanced life. If this code sounds eerily familiar, it should. Again, recall my episode, The Day Chivalry Died, and the Knights of France. It's an incredible oddity of history that two societies on the opposite sides of the globe evolved almost identical warrior codes, samurai and knights. And just like the knights of Europe, most samurai only paid lip service to the code and conducted themselves in any way they felt like. Cruelty, lies, betrayal, and a complete lack of empathy more accurately describe most samurai. Japan's first unifier, Oda Nobunaga, for example, though often generous and open-handed with his favored allies, could be ruthless with his vassals and ordered the mass murder of his enemies. He had to. He was born into the chaos of Sengoku Jidai. It was kill or be killed, be feared or be seen as weak. And only in the rarest of cases could anyone be trusted. Yasuke would have also learned of many of the other oddities of samurai culture, like their names. Let's take Oda Nobunaga, for example.
Oda? I'm trying to say it.
Oda Nobunaga.
Copy that, Lore Master.
The first part of his name, Oda, is his clan's name.
meaning he is of the Oda clan. The second name, Nobunaga, is the last in a very long line of second names. You see, as samurai rise higher in rank or achieve greater deeds, their second names sort of level up to reflect their new status. In our tale, I'm using his ultimate and most famous name for simplicity. Perhaps because he was completely foreign was why Oda Nobunaga trusted and liked Yasuke, a warrior from an alien culture, who could become a true friend because he owed no other allegiance to anyone else in Japan. Already a devastating warrior, Yasuke quickly learned the code and customs of the samurai. It seems that he almost naturally became an informal bodyguard to the unifier and was continually instructed in samurai philosophy and the ways of the court. Before long, Yasuke had mastered the Bushido code, and Oda Nobunaga presented him with a short katana, the Wakizashi. This sword, designed for close-quarter combat, was exactly the type of weapon that a Kalaripat warrior was trained to use with a small shield. Another clue to Yasuke's origin. The ceremony was conducted in what would become Yasuke's house on the palace grounds, and he was named weapon-bearer to the unifier and hailed as samurai, the first gaijin, foreigner, ever to attain the exalted rank. During this time period, he must have impressed the Oda clan greatly with his skill of using cannon, because he was soon put in charge of a battery and responsible for training men to become proficient in their use. He would also have been measured and fitted in traditional samurai armor. With his height and size, he would have been an impressive and intimidating presence at the unifier's side, the one and only African samurai. Now think back to that trip we took to the Battle of Nagashino Castle, where you, Oda Nobunaga, and your friend, Tokugawa Ieyasu, vanquished the bulk of the samurai knights of the Takeda clan. That battle wasn't the beginning or end of the war with the Takeda. After the horrific loss, their power had steadily dwindled. Both Oda and especially Tokugawa Ieyasu pursued and hunted down their leaders one by one. And now, soon after Yasuke becomes samurai, word reaches the capital that Tokugawa Ieyasu has at last trapped the elusive leader, Takeda Katsuyori, in his clan's last castle, a mighty citadel high in the mountains. And Tokugawa needs reinforcements to besiege it. The Oda and a large honor guard, including Yasuke, ride hard, gathering forces along the way from the provinces. The Oda is eager to be there to witness the end of one of his most hated foes, the very last heir of the ancient Takeda clan. Upon arriving at the siege, Yasuke meets the legendary daimyo and samurai warrior Tokugawa Ieyasu, who was very impressed by him and made note of Yasuke's size and skill at arms. The African samurai is put in charge of Oda's siege cannons, and the castle walls are slowly shot after devastating shot brought down. Before they are fully breached, however, Takeda Katsuyori sets the castle ablaze and flees to a mountain hideout. The men there want nothing to do with the Oda or Tokugawa armies, so they deny him entry. With no hope left, the last Takeda commits seppuku, ritual suicide. In the following days, escorted by their army, Oda and Tokugawa begin their progress through the Takeda province, now their land. Taking stock of its resources, towns, and castles, this is when a messenger reaches them and tells the unifier that another vassal is in desperate need of reinforcements in the south. Oda Nobunaga calls a war council, and it is decided that Tokugawa Ieyasu will see to securing their new lands, and Oda's army will take the direct road to the south to answer the plea for aid. It should be noted that samurai, though not exactly religious, were extremely superstitious. After the council, the Oda asks his monk and astrologer if he made a wise decision. The monk informs him that the omens favor a good outcome only if he returns to Kyoto and performs a religious tea ceremony in the sacred Buddhist temple of Hanoji. It would take weeks for his whole army to march back to the city, and weeks more to march to the south. Weeks his ally didn't have, so he made a fateful decision. He took a small honor guard and rode hard to the temple to hold the ceremony, while his army continued south. After the ceremony, he would then ride back in time to take command and relieve his ally. Thus, with a bodyguard of just 20 samurai, including Yasuke, Oda Nobunaga, the first unifier of Japan, galloped towards the capital and his fate. They reached the temple in the late evening on June 20th, 1582. Though it was already dark in the streets, they were spotted, and word of the unifier and his small honor guard's arrival spread throughout the city, and soon reached the ears of a vassal daimyo who happened to be passing through the city with his army on his way back from campaigning in the provinces. Recall that the unifier's reign was maintained through fear and terror, which means that many of his vassals only followed him because they had to, or else their clans would be wiped out. In the context of Sengoku Jidai, only showing overwhelming strength and power at all times kept those with grudges and ambitious followers in line. Displaying the slightest weakness or letting one's guard down for an instant could mean death. When this vassal, a daimyo named Akechi Mitsuhide, learned that the unifier was in a lightly fortified temple with a mere 20 samurai as bodyguards, he saw his chance. In his mind, if he killed Oda Nobunaga, seized the capital, and sent his army to kill Oda's heir immediately, in the ensuing chaos, he could entrench himself and the power would be his. It was a very risky plan. Oda Nobunaga had powerful friends, but remember the code of the samurai. Calculated risk is what gives life its spice. Now I could just tell you what happened, and I would no doubt do so ever so suavely. But this is deep into history, and you're with your friend and lore master Arjun. So prepare yourself to enter Yasuke and go to war with the African samurai. Because the events at the Temple of Hanoji in the early morning hours of June 21st, 1582, might have gone something like this. You were walking on the dew-laden stones of the central courtyard of the Temple of Hanoji in Kyoto. You look at the moon's position in the sky and know it's only a few hours till dawn. Though you are exhausted from the long days of hard riding to reach the capital and could definitely use rest, you've allowed others to get sleep first. The men of the Unifier's bodyguard are all disciplined samurai, but only you have trained to remain fully alert while deprived of sleep at the Kalari Temple in your faraway homeland. You stand guard with 8 men. Most are patrolling various parts of the grounds of the temple, and a few are manning the short and ornate towers at each corner of the equally ornate walls. Though the beautifully carved doors of the wooden gate at the entrance archway are sealed and barred, you know they would not be much of an obstacle for a determined foe to penetrate. This is a temple of Buddha, dedicated to peace, not a castle constructed for war. It is a place of tranquility with elegant lines, not harsh angles. Inside the temple are a few retainers with the unifier, who is with the monks performing a holy tea ceremony to bring his army omens of victory it apparently cannot do without. You know something of Buddhism. You are from the country of its origin, after all, but you've never heard of such rituals in India. The latest in a series of seemingly daily reminders that though you are samurai, you are still a stranger in a strange land, and have barely begun to understand this alien honor culture. The other samurai of the bodyguard are no doubt enjoying a dreamless sleep as they drew a rest period for the first watch. You stretch your arms out to your side and roll your shoulders. You have come to have great admiration for the skill with which your armor was crafted, with hundreds of small steel discs woven into the cloth and leather, but you're still not fully accustomed to its weight. It does not yet feel natural. Attached to your left arm is your Kalari shield, a small buckler, and at your waist is your wakizashi, the razor-sharp short sword presented to you by the unifier himself. You smile to yourself, proud and honored to have been taught the ways of the samurai by such a man, and even more proud to have showed such a great warrior something of the warrior code and ways of your people, the city. He is more to you than your daimyo. More than the unifier, Oda Nobunaga has become your dearest friend,
and you do not bestow your friendship lightly. Beyond the walls, from the near distance in the city, you hear a dog start barking. Seconds later, joined by another, and then suddenly many more. Something was wrong. Then you hear the patter of hundreds of armored feet. "Soldiers, protect the Oda!" yells one of your comrades in the tower to your right. His cry of alarm suddenly cut off as he falls onto his knees, grasping at the arrow shot from beyond the wall and now hopelessly lodged in his throat. A samurai in the other tower falls out into the courtyard, his body slamming onto the ground hard, dead weight, with numerous arrows protruding from his armor.
"Geho!"
you yell, the Japanese word for alarm. But before you can go have a look at who or what is coming, you hear a loud crack and the temple's gate shudders from the impact of a battering ram. Followed a few seconds later by another booming crash as splinters erupt from the newly formed cracks in the wood. The ornate gate would not hold for long. Katanas drawn. Two friendly samurai take up places on either side of you. As another samurai runs up to you, you say,
"We must get the unifier out of the temple now."
"We are surrounded,"
he answers, breathlessly, no hope in his voice. Your training kicks in. You study your surroundings and search. And there, from the rooftop of one of the buildings attached to the temple, it might just be possible to jump across the street to a lower building, provided you could get a running start. Your head snaps back to the gate as with a final loud crash, it bursts apart. Splinters of wood spray the courtyard and bounce off your armor. The metal's demon head on the tip of the ram sneers at you. From the corners of your eyes, you see attackers' heads popping up from behind the walls who must be using scaling ladders. Within seconds, a few are over and have dropped down into the courtyard and are rushing towards you. You draw your wakizashi from its sheath, but just as you are about to step forward to meet the attackers, they are shot with arrows. You dare to take a glance behind you at the entrance to the temple and see Oda Nobunaga, dressed in the white silk robe he was required to wear for the tea ceremony. He had not had time to don his armor. The 10 bodyguards with him were all aiming and firing bows at the men coming over the walls.
"Rally to me,"
he orders loudly but calmly, as he channels everything he is feeling, fear, dread, anger, hatred, into his actions. It is the way of the samurai. You and the men with you dash back to stand in front of him. Once there, the 16 samurai and the unifier stand ready to face the enemies that are beginning to come through the broken gate. When the colors of the banners attached to the poles on some of their backs become clear to you, you hear the unifier say the name
Akechi,
as if it's a curse word.
"Death to the traitors,"
he yells as he draws his katana free from its scabbard on his waist. You barely hear it because you have entered your battle trance, moving into your defensive stance designed and practiced against multiple enemies. And suddenly, the enemy are upon you. Your acrobatic kalariput confounds your attackers as you block, dodge, parry, and flawlessly riposte. Each cut from your wakizashi lethal, for you have spent your life, including your life as a samurai, training for this moment. This is the melding of your two warrior codes and your unique style's ultimate test. The enemy samurai you are facing are also lifelong adherents to their warrior code and very skilled. Though your size, strength, and completely alien technique are holding them back for now. But this cannot go on forever. You bring down four enemies, but after slashing your fifth attacker across the eye slits of his helmet, your sword becomes lodged in his shoulder pads. Disarmed, you are forced to take a step back and find yourself next to the unifier.
"Retreat into the temple,"
he orders and begins to back through the doorway. You and the 7 remaining samurai of his bodyguard mimic his movements. The courtyard is now full of enemies, with more coming in from every direction. 5 remain to block the entrance. As the unifier motions for you to follow him into the interior, as you run through the maze of hallways, you pass terrified monks
and still others brandishing daggers and clubs preparing to defend their temple. You enter a chamber with a long table set with an elaborate tea service, which you realize must have been the site of the ceremony. Theoda has turned to face you.
Daimyo,
you say,
if we reach the roof, there may be a way to escape.
For the briefest instant, it seems like he's hopeful, like he's the man you've come to know, full of other emotions besides the marshal. But then it's gone, and his normal stoic face returns, and he's the unifier again.
I was almost shogun,
he says.
Daimyo of Daimyo, warlord of warlords. Yasuke, my friend, I cannot flee. It would bring dishonor to my name and shame to my clan forever.
He looks at you with a rare smile on his face.
I have a final mission for you, my friend. I need you to warn my son and here at Ninjio Castle. Tell him of Akachi's betrayal. Tell him to get word to Tokugawa and Toyotomi. They will answer his call. Tell him I died with my honor intact.
You feel hot tears spilling uncontrollably from your eyes. Unable to speak, you extend your arm, and Oda Nobunaga, your friend, your brother, grasps it firmly for the last time.
Go. Now.
He says, his voice breaking ever so slightly. Unable to look at your friend anymore without losing your composure, you turn and begin running through the maze of hallways until you find the staircase that allows you to reach the roof. You run to the end of the narrow and flat rooftop. There you see that you may just be able to make the jump to the lower building across the street, but only if you remove the weight of your heavy armor. You pull off your helmet and begin the laborious process of removing it, untying knots, undoing straps, and leather buckles. Desperate minutes pass as you strip down to your padded undergarments. Just as you finish, you see flames bursting out of the window near the section of the temple where you'd left your friend, at last free of your armor, and you are about to run to your escape. You see an Akechi samurai come up the stairs, roar a battle cry, raises a katana in both hands over his head, and charge at you. He is just a few dozen paces away. You don't think. It's reflex. You bring your legs together, standing straight. Your head tilted slightly back, and your arms brought in tight to your sides. Your hands, fists. You breathe in deeply to center yourself, so you can channel your grief and rage emanating from the center of your being. All other noise fades away as you count the steps your enemy is taking towards you. You open your red eyes, and through the blurring effect of your tears, you see him near and decide it's time. With the fluidity of a wave and all the power of a tsunami, you lunge forward and in the same motion strike out with both fists into the center of the oncoming samurai's chest. It's not just your fists. Your will, your entire being is focused into the strike. And the energy of your motions flows out through your knuckles and into his chest. As if in slow motion, his face changes from the frenzy of battle to anger, to confusion, to misunderstanding, then disbelief, and finally utter horror, just as the sounds of cracking bones reach both of your ears. For the briefest instant, you are not in this foreign land, but long ago at your Kalari temple with your combat yoga master smiling down proudly at you the day you had managed to master the technique. The samurai collapses in front of you, dead, his ribcage shattered. You turn and sprint for the roof's edge, and then jump into the night, trusting the speed and timing of the jump to your memory, because the mission was everything. This was how a Siddhi trained in the temples of Karnataka and risen by merit to the rank of the samurai made war. At least it might have gone like that. The ambush at Hanoji Temple was vicious, and surprise was complete. Oda Nobunaga had made a huge mistake by moving with so few samurai. And in the hellfire of Sengoku Jedi, mistakes meant death, especially for powerful daimyo. The only upside being that Yasuke escaped to carry out his mission. As enemy samurai began to try to force their way into the room where they had carried out the tea ceremony, the last bodyguard with Oda Nobunaga set the entrance on fire to delay them long enough so that he could be second to his master during his seppuku, ritual suicide. Kneeling, the first unifier of Japan stabbed deeply into his abdomen and then slashed across from left to right, where the samurai believed the soul dwelt, and his life was ended by a slash across his neck by his loyal retainer, who then went on to commit seppuku by himself. We have no idea how, but Yasuke made it out of the city and by many reports fought and ambushed his way, re-equipping himself with the weapons and armor of a catchy samurai he came across after he killed them, of course. He reached Ninjo Castle just ahead of the pursuing Akechi army. Once inside the castle, he told the heir named Oda Nobutada about his father's death and his last instructions. I can't find a single source that can solidly confirm whether or not the new head of the Oda clan was able to send messengers to Tokugawa Ieyasu or Toyotomi Hideyoshi, because if he did, I have no doubt at least one of his father's most faithful retainers would have come to aid him with their army. Either one of them was many more times more powerful than the Akechi clan, not to mention that the Oda clan's army was still in the field marching south, the whole reason for the fateful trip to the temple, and they would most certainly have been sent for had he been able to. Since no relief came, this implies that Yasuke had to rush to keep just ahead of the Akechi army, thus making it to the castle just in time to be besieged along with the Oda heir. The letter of his mission complete, but definitely not the spirit in which it was given. For without quick relief, the castle would fall, and the heir, his friend's oldest son, would die. Without the heir, though Oda Nobunaga had many other sons, none were old enough to be samurai, thus leaving his clan without a daimyo. Every clan had factions, and without the Oda heir, the clan could potentially tear itself apart in a dynastic civil war. This was exactly why the Akechi army made the mad dash across the province to the castle. The details of the very short siege and quick storming of Ninjo Castle are few. What we do know is that the Akechi forces attacked and forced entrance, either over the walls or by breaching the gate with a ram. Vastly outnumbered, the Oda forces, Yasuke with them, fought valiantly but in a lost cause. They held just long enough to allow the heir, Oda Nobutada, the time to follow his father's example and commit seppuku. Yasuke fought on until he was the last defender standing. Surrounded, exhausted, and in a hopeless fight, he was taken prisoner. He was brought before the traitorous daimyo Akechi Mitsuhide, who berated Yasuke as an animal, barbarian, and gaijin who knew nothing of the ways of Japan. He said it would bring personal dishonor to order his death. So instead, he had him return to the new church in Kyoto, where the Jesuit Alessandro Valignano was based. The true reason for the decision to spare him, however, was more likely that the Akechi desperately needed access to Portuguese guns, cannon, and other imports. By now, many knew the strange tale of the African samurai and how he came to the island. So not wishing to offend the Jesuit, they sent him back. Unfortunately, this is the last time Yasuke is ever mentioned in history. We don't know what happened after he was returned to the church. People have speculated that he most likely left the island on a Portuguese ship and made his way back to his homeland. Others say that devastated by the loss of his friend and his failure to protect his heir, Yasuke wandered Japan as a ronin, a masterless samurai. To me, this seems unlikely. So in place of history, I would like to offer you a story, a local legend of sorts from Goa in India. It says that in the late 16th century, a Portuguese galley was found beached on its side to the south of the small port city. The galley had come from the far east and was full of silks and valuables, all intact, left sitting in the hold, undisturbed. The crew, however, was found dead or missing, and the vessel's slaves were gone. They had vanished, their chains unlocked, their bonds broken. I like to think that Yasuke, the African samurai, led them in an uprising against their cruel masters. When the ship neared Goa, and then led the newly freed men to the safety of the hills of Karnataka so that they could learn the art of Kalaripat and the ways of the proud and glorious city, so that they could never be made slaves again. Thank you for listening to Deep into History. I truly hope you enjoyed Enter Yasuke, the African Samurai. To support this show for just cents a day, please go to patreon.com/deepintohistory. I could really use your help. You can follow me on most social media at Deep into History to get your daily blast from the past. And as always, my dear friend, take care of yourself. I truly look forward to the next time we go deep. Deep into History is produced by York Campbell from Poetic Earthling Studio.
Thank you for listening to.
And the introduction is performed by Shante, who you can find at ctamarketing.biz.
Deep into History.